Local Talk is the signature local interview program on KHOI that explores people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. It celebrates the creativity, diversity, and civic spirit of our community. This interview aired on Local Talk.
Well, it's interesting to have for me to have this chance to reflect on what's been going on in terms of queer identity, queer rights, and culturally what's been happening. And I was thinking about the impact of history, and remember a time when there was a queer bar, gay bar, in Des Moines on the south side, just on the south side of the river. And there were two men, professional men from Des Moines, who used to come up to Ames regularly for the gay gathering here. And they and a few others in a week similar to Pride Week were featured at that bar. And one evening was a history. And this would have been, I don't know, maybe somewhere in the 80s. Jack and Bob were their names. And one had been in personnel administration in the Des Moines school system, and the other, I forget what his professional involvement was. But that evening at the bar, we were talking about what was going on in the various decades, in the 40s and 50s and 60s. And we went decade by decade. And there were some young people, if this was in the 80s, I would have been in my 40s. And there were some people who were late teens, early 20s. And as a result of that, they were totally amazed. And they said, we had no idea that there was a history like this. All we knew was our own part of the story. And we're part of a long history of people working at this and experiencing. And it was a magical moment for us to share how meaningful this look at history was for these young folks who didn't have a perspective. And for me, to know what was going on in the decades before I had much involvement and awareness, because Jack and Bob were 20 years older than I or somewhere in that. And I remember some of the first gatherings, I didn't know whether I could go or not. And I was told it was safe, but I was married and I had children and I was a pastor, part-time pastor of a young developing group here. And in that group, we were studying human sexuality and focusing on inclusion of what we now call GLBTQ folk. But that was very cutting edge, and it was something that in our denomination, our Mennonite district, was not being done. And I was used to being involved in my pastoral work with fringe people, quote, minority folks and people on the edge. And in my peace and justice work, I was a conscientious objector. And of course, being a conscientious objector in the Vietnam War days was very controversial. So I was used to, based on my own particular faith and my understanding of Scripture, focusing on God's love for all people. But knowing my own preference or increasingly awareness that my natural proclivity was a deep, intimate relationship with men, although I had thought clearly that God was leading me to a woman years before and that would save me from this evil of homosexuality, there was all this conflictedness about what I could do professionally and personally. And so when this opportunity came that the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Ames was making available a place that was called Safe Space for us to meet. Nobody else in the community would have access to the building when we were there. And that meant that it might even be possible to drive up to the parking lot without being known or, quote, outing ourselves. It was still a big risk, but it was an amazing service that was being given. And I don't remember exact dates when that gathering started, but I do know that it was before I came out to my kids. And I came out to my kids when they were in high school. My wife had known increasingly of my proclivity, or what was that was the term used at that time. And so those gatherings were times when, yes, we would use only first names, and we met to tell our story. And it was such a relief to be able to tell somebody our story who understood. And we didn't, it was a small group, I don't recall. It got bigger in time and people came from Des Moines. But it was an amazing time when we could take a breath for a short period of time and know that in some way, at some level, we were understood. And we were not considered evil or dangerous or anti-spiritual. Reflecting on it now, I'm amazed at what a breath freedom that was. That I think it's hard for many people who haven't had to deal with that kind of extremely strong public civic pressure. It'd be very hard for them to understand. So there's that, and of course the group expanded from there then on, and eventually felt we could include women, and then this strange group, bisexuals, and we had struggles with increasing because there was a sense of trust and warmth that had developed, and each time that expanded, it meant taking a risk, but it always turned out to be good. Then we had a woman who became president. I think the first woman who became president of the group was bisexual, and having a bisexual person in the group and then becoming president. I mean, for her to become president took a lot of affirmation in the group. But it was a progression of understanding and trust. In those years, I was beginning to work more on counseling and getting some additional training at Iowa State that would certify me as a marriage and family therapist. And later in 93, when Iowa developed a licensure program for marriage and family therapists, I was in the early months of that formal grouping that was recognized professionally in the state. And in the process, whether it was at state level or national level of our American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy, I became increasingly involved in helping to develop a task force, we called it. That was a very conservative mental health profession at that point, but that would help the board and the structures of the organization to become more open to people who were, quote, at that time called homosexuals. And so the culture of the country and the culture of Iowa as well was quite foreign and in many ways hostile to gay, lesbian, bisexual, queer folks, as we now tend to call ourselves in some areas. It was during that time that to be able to speak for ourselves eventually, which I did in the board of my American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy in 1990, and find that there was willingness to hear a member's, I was also a supervisor in the organization and could supervise new folks who were training. And to find that the group even was glad and welcomed my voice, that was strange, because in the church at that time, the church that I represented, Mennonite Church, which was very different from the Unitarian Universalists, who were quite open, but like most other denominations at that time, we were pariahs or people to be most distrusted. Kind of the common sense in the culture was that all we were out for was sex and to pervert young boys. And those are still painful thoughts that strike deep sorrow in me, even as I state those terms, because they were such whipping tools that increased the sense of shame and rejection and unacceptability that we as gay men had in those days. Which brings me to 1990, as in Ames here, Ames Boone, a dramatic event that became national and international news. Before then, I had resigned pastoring, and our little Mennonite congregation had been ejected after a lot of anguish and talking together on sides of leadership and so on from the Iowa-Nebraska Mennonite Conference because we were welcoming of LGBTQ folk. And so in the late 80s, I was part of the group that was involved when our little congregation was ejected from the conference, from the district. And I became clear at that point also that I could no longer consider that perhaps God had created me as I was. Created in God's image always meant straight, of course. And the scriptures, there were, quote, seven clobber scriptures that were often used to condemn us and or our behavior, so to speak, in those days, and in some groups still are used. So I felt very condemned and also a dismal failure because I wasn't able to, in our church terms, able to overcome the besetting sin of homosexuality. So by the late 80s, by 87, about the time that I was finally deciding, Rhoda and I had been talking about what we were going to do and the possibility of divorce. I had married Rhoda because I had a direct experience from God. That's my experience of this. That God led me to a woman. Now, what I had thought, hoped, understood was if God led me to a woman, then I would no longer be, quote, tempted to want to have intimate relationships, sex, with a man. And I thought, oh, great. Finally, something's here to save me from this wretched condition that I'm in that I can't, no matter what, I can't shake. Well, interesting. Because some months after the marriage, lo and behold, attractive men caught my eye, and my heart dropped. Wasn't God faithful? Had God deserted me? My father had been a pastor, and was in those days yet. His father had been a pastor. I come from a long tradition of service to God in the Mennonite tradition. It goes back to Switzerland in the 1600s. At any rate. So it was time. Had to bite the bullet. I had the best counselor in all Des Moines, in all Iowa, to work with for some time. And Larry is still alive, bless him, and straight man, United Methodist minister who advocates for people who happen to be GLBT. At any rate, I got to the point where I experienced a relationship that was deeply spiritual with a man. And it included affection and sexual affection. And by that point, I could no longer provide any sexual activity service to my wife, who really enjoyed. I couldn't honor her. And so the dilemma was, then what is the best thing to do? And I got counsel from an amazing Catholic priest, pastor friend, and other folks. I'm going to have to deal with the marriage question. Susan, I had covenanted before God and 150 guests, family, and wonderful people from Canada and the U.S. to be in committed, loving, caring relationship with Rhoda until life parted us. And I was talking about breaking that covenant. It seemed to me that the best thing I could do was to I couldn't live in secret anymore. I had to be honest and open with who I am. And I had to release Rhoda so that she could have a relationship with a man who really appreciated her as a woman and wanted her as a woman, sexually as well as in other ways. So, in late 87, I told my folks that. I don't recall whether it was Oh, yes, it was in a phone call. And Dad said, well, Keith will be praying for you. To me, that's the deepest, most loving, most caring thing my dad could say. And a few days later, there was a phone call from him. Maybe I told him that they came to visit us. It doesn't matter. They came from Virginia at that time. Dad was 80-something years old, 81 or 2. And in the phone call, Dad said, and there was a message on the tape, Dad, and I called him and he said, I found it. I said, what did you find, Dad? He said, and of course he was reading scripture as well as praying. And in both the Old Testament and the New Testament, there's reference made to eunuchs in the tradition of faith. Eunuchs are men who can't function sexually because some have been made that way by men. They've been castrated, in other words, or were born that way. And they were full participants in the household of faith, whether it was a Jewish tradition or Christian tradition. Dad said, I found it. That's all it takes. My dad was looking for any way that he could to accept me. What more can a parent give a child?
You can hear more interviews like this on Local Talk, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m., on 89.1 KHOI Community Radio. You can support Community Radio through the donate button at khoifm.org.